From Virginia to Nebraska, Maryland to California, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, President Trump has outlined a plan to address the skyrocketing cost of health insurance. Brian Blaze from the Paragon Health Institute is here with details. Congress is once again up against a federal budget deadline, but it doesn't look like another partial shutdown is in the offing. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Certificate of need laws stifle economic competition, and a challenge to one such law is headed to the Mississippi Supreme Court. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Tim Sandifer of the Goldwater Institute. And the Declaration of Independence made the right to life one of our nation's founding principles. Keith Rothfuss has an American Radio Journal commentary on why we should continue to uphold that principle. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The so-called Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, has made health care more unaffordable than ever. President Donald Trump has proposed some reforms. Brian Blaze is president of the Paragon Health Institute. He is a former special assistant to President Trump for economic policy. He joins us now with details. Brian, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Brian, it appears that healthcare costs just keep going higher and higher by double digits every year. The Affordable Care Act, not so affordable. President Trump is attempting to address that in a number of ways. So let's talk about that. Particularly, he seems to be focused on this idea of turning the emphasis away from insurance companies to patients. Do you think that's the direction we should go?
I do. We have a healthcare system that is not driven by the patient. We have a healthcare system where the vast majority of spending goes through third-party payers, whether it is by government programs or health insurance company bureaucracies, and the patient isn't in control. And when the patient's not in control, that means the providers aren't serving the patient directly. There are examples in healthcare where the patient is in control, where they're spending directly for the services. LASIK eye surgery, cosmetic surgery are two good examples. In those markets, prices have come down while quality has dramatically improved. We need to take lessons from what has worked in healthcare, what works in the rest of the economy, that when providers have to compete in a competitive market for the consumer's dollars, products get better and more affordable over time. What we have in healthcare is exactly the opposite.
In the Unaffordable Care Act, can you address specifically what components of it really throw a damper on such competition?
The Affordable Care Act has two primary parts. It's got a regulatory regime. The regulatory regime mandated what insurance had to cover, and then it mandated how it could be priced. So the key problem with pricing in the Affordable Care Act is that insurers can't give discounts for healthy people. So you have one person who is very healthy, one person who is very sick. Insurance company can't make a difference in the premium. That leads to a host of problems. It leads to insurance plan quality to deteriorate because insurers want to try to avoid sick people, so they design poor products. So those regulations have dramatically increased premiums. In order for people to afford the coverage, the government had to put in place large subsidies. Really, the main story of the ACA to date is that the only people who purchase the plans need massive subsidies. Sometimes, in many cases, actually, the subsidies need to cover the full premium for people to purchase the plans. These subsidies were juiced up during COVID by the Democrats and by President Biden. And what we need to do is rationalize this system. So give people more options of health insurance plans and also direct these subsidies away from funding the system to giving patients the control over the resources.
The president also has taken some recent steps relative to the cost of prescription drugs. Brian, can you tell us a bit about what has occurred there?
This is the president's number one health policy priority. I was at the White House when he laid out the great health care plan, and he spent quite a bit of time talking about the most favored nation proposal. The president's main concern in this space is that for brand drugs, Americans pay many times more what people in other developed countries pay. It leads to the situation where Americans are really financing the research and development of pharmaceutical products for people around the globe. President Trump's main idea here is what he calls most favored nation pricing, where you take a set of rich countries, like those that have comparable per capita GDP to the U.S., and you say for new drugs, what Americans are going to buy, what the price that Americans face isn't going to be more than the best deal that the pharmaceutical companies give individuals in the lowest price of this other set of countries. He has negotiated 16 deals with pharmaceutical companies. They've come to the table under concern about tariffs and other adverse actions if they didn't reach agreement with the administration. And it really is a significant policy development, and it will, in my view, lead to some significantly lower prices for new drugs over the coming years for Americans.
In terms of the president's health care plan that you were at the White House, what other key components did the president outline in those comments?
So the most favored nation drug pricing is one plank. The second plank is not sending even more subsidies to health insurance companies. There's some reforms that would lower the premiums for the most common Obamacare plan, and the directive that subsidies should be redirected away from going to health insurers, to patients. Paragon's actually put out the most developed plan in this area. It's called the HSA option. It would redirect a portion of the Obamacare subsidies away from insurers to patients. And the third key plank are price transparency efforts. So in his first term, President Trump issued rules that required hospitals and insurers to post upfront real price information. The Biden administration really neglected implementation of those rules, and the president is indicating that he is going to devote more attention to enforcement and making sure that hospitals and insurers comply so that Americans have upfront pricing information.
Brian Blaze is president of the Paragon Health Institute. Brian, tell us a little bit about Paragon. Also, where can folks find you on the web? You've indicated you have rather extensive policy proposals here. Tell us where you can find those.
Paragon has been around for a little more than 4 years. We are a public policy research center that focuses on health policy, and we really evaluate how government programs are actually working, and we develop a set of policy recommendations that are consistent with free market and limited government principles.
Brian Blaze of the Paragon Health Institute. Brian, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, a rapidly approaching deadline once again on the federal budget, but a lot of political activity around the country. We're going to cover all the bases with Scott Parkinson. Scott, great having you back with us.
It's my pleasure.
Briefly here, Scott, because there are a lot of moving parts that are going to be taking place throughout the coming week. Once again, we face another continuing resolution federal budget deadline.
You might remember from the longest federal government shutdown ever earlier this fall that Congress went ahead and punted the appropriations process through a continuing resolution to the end of January. And they've been trying to work through what are known as minibus appropriation bills. Some of them have passed the House. Some of them have been through the Senate. And they're trying to basically load them up through a rule, the procedural hurdles of the House of Representatives, accommodate passage prior to that end of January deadline. I think it's going to be very unlikely that we actually see another big, massive fight over a government shutdown. It seems like things are headed in the right direction. And as Mitch McConnell used to say, there's no education in the second kick of a mule. So a lot of these members do not want to see another prolonged shutdown. And, you know, you remember, Lohman, the Democrats basically shut the government down in October so that they could use it as a political wedge on the health care issue for those off-year elections in states like Virginia and New Jersey, where Democrats did pretty well. And I think health care is still sort of hanging out there as a big issue, but we did pass that December 31st deadline for the Biden COVID premium tax credit subsidy issue, and premiums for 2026 are already baked in through the risk assessment of insurance companies. So I think that they'll still continue to sort of work on some level of a health care reform bill in 2026. But, you know, bipartisanship on that issue is probably not going to be in the realm of possibilities, because I do think that Democrats want to continue to campaign on that question in the midterms next, you know, fall. So one thing that the Trump administration and Mike Johnson and John Thune have considered is doing another reconciliation package once they get this appropriations process resolved. I do think that that would be very, very challenging given the slim majority that we have in the House of Representatives. We obviously had the passing of Doug LaMalfa in the First District of California a few weeks ago, and it's a numbers game. It's very, very challenging to get everybody rowing in the same direction in Congress. They say it's like herding cats, and imagine having 435 cats, maybe a few vacancies, where it makes things even more challenging.
Well, we will continue to keep an eye on that. Let's now switch over to the political side of the equation, Scott. And the U.S. Senate, Republicans in control there, trying to stay in control of the United States Senate. Let's talk about a couple of key races, starting out with Alabama, some major developments.
President Trump's endorsement matters a lot in Republican primaries, especially in red areas. And in this instance, you've got Coach Tommy Tuberville, the U.S. Senator, running for governor. President Trump endorsed him several months ago, and that created an open race for the Senate seat. Congressman Barry Moore, Attorney General Steve Marshall, there's a Navy SEAL named Jared Hudson, and then another businessman, and I think he does some journalism, a guy named Morgan Murphy, that are running in that primary. So President Trump has been sort of weighing his options on who to support in that race. And last Saturday, he came out with his complete and total endorsement for Barry Moore. Barry Moore was actually the first politician in the country to publicly endorse President Trump and his candidacy in 2015. And President Trump remembers that loyalty from somebody like Barry Moore. He mentioned it in his Truth Social, and the Club for Growth PAC also followed up President Trump's endorsement with an endorsement for Congressman Moore in that U.S. Senate race. We're really excited for Barry and his family and his supporters. We think he's going to be a tremendous senator, but it is a competitive Republican primary given the number of people that are running, and that's why the Trump endorsement is even more important for somebody like Barry Moore to clinch the nomination this May.
Sliding a bit west along the Gulf Coast, looks like things are really heating up in Louisiana.
Yeah, in Louisiana, you might remember during one of those Trump impeachments, Bill Cassidy voted to impeach President Trump, one of the Republicans that voted for impeachment. And while Cassidy has tried to work with the administration on some key nominations, he's also tried to be influential when it comes to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the school choice provision and a lot of other things. The bottom line is that there's a personal element to the way that President Trump supports people, and that's what I'm talking about with Barry Moore being the first member or the first politician to support President Trump. Trump's just not going to forget that Cassidy opposed him and voted for impeachment. And in this instance, I think that they worked behind the scenes, and President Trump last weekend came out with his endorsement for a pretty new Congresswoman, Julia Letlow. Julia Letlow won a special election for the House of Representatives, I think after the 2020 election, after her husband actually died during the intervening period from election day to swearing in, so it created a special election. And she won it. She's sort of been favorite of the Louisiana establishment, which is in contrast to how Cassidy has sort of run afoul of folks that do want to be productive and work with the administration. So President Trump working with Julia Letlow on that endorsement is a big deal for her.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, as we always do here, Scott. Tell us just a little bit about the Club for Growth and where folks can find you.
You can check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org. We are based out of Washington, D.C., and we're united in the idea of economic freedom and liberty and opportunity. You can actually visit that website and sign up for free, clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
The Goldwater Institute is challenging a Mississippi law that requires certificates of needs, which actually suppress free market competition. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Tim Sandifer of the Goldwater Institute.
One of the reasons why healthcare costs are so high in this country is that we artificially limit the availability of care. And in a lot of states, that artificial limit takes the form of something called a certificate of need law, a con law. And if you're a regular listener of this program, then you've probably heard me talk about these things before. They're not all that well known, but I think they are particularly pernicious problems in our healthcare industry. And so that's why I'm really glad today to talk about a situation in Mississippi where some of those certificate of need laws are under a legal attack. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Tim Sandifer. He is the Vice President for Legal Affairs at the Goldwater Institute, and he joins us now to talk about an amicus brief that Goldwater has filed in a case that's going before the Mississippi Supreme Court, challenging some of those con laws down there. Tim, thank you so much for joining us here.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Before we get into the specifics of what's going on down there in Mississippi, Tim, can you just give us a little overview here of what certificate of need laws are and kind of how they work?
Certificate of need laws, or con laws as we call them, appropriately enough, are laws that I also like to refer to as competitor's veto laws, meaning that they're laws that say if you want to go into business, you have to first get permission from all the existing companies that are already doing business in that industry. So these kinds of laws apply to everything from moving companies in limousines to medical and psychological care facilities. And they say if you want to open, you know, a new moving company or a new medical clinic, you have to file an application with the state. It then notifies all of the existing competitors and allows them to object to you getting a license. And when that happens, then you have to go in front of a government bureaucracy and prove to them that there's a public need for your new business. And what does public need mean? And nobody really knows. It just means whatever the bureaucrats say that it means.
Yeah, every time I cover these things or talk about them, I'm struck by just how much it sounds like something out of the old Soviet Union. It doesn't sound like the way we're supposed to do things here in America.
In fact, several years ago, I did a lawsuit involving these kinds of laws, and I had the government witness there in deposition. He was the guy who was in charge of granting or denying certificate of need laws or certificates of need for moving companies. And I asked him, what criteria do you use? And he testified under oath, there are no objective criteria.
Yeah, sure. Like, who needs objective standards, right? Let's just let the bureaucrats have all the power. I'm sure they'll figure it out. What could possibly go wrong? Tim, you mentioned how these laws take on kind of different forms in different states, transportation industries in many cases, but healthcare industries are some of the most heavily regulated by con laws. And that's where it's always struck me as like, that's the area where they're particularly problematic because obviously healthcare is quite expensive and many people don't have adequate access to healthcare, and these laws are making those problems worse. And that is really at the crux of this case in Mississippi that Goldwater is now involved in.
That's right. This case involves the state law that says that you can't open a new psychological care facility, right? A person who's having perhaps a suicidal situation or, you know, and needs medication for schizophrenia or something like that. You can't open a new clinic to provide those services as long as the existing clinics can assert that, well, our facilities aren't being used to the maximum amount possible. Well, of course, no facility is going to be used to the maximum amount possible, so that gives them basically an indefinite right to object to the opening of a new clinic. And this can lead to not just you know, people in need suffering because they don't get the care they need, but it can lead to crime and violence because these people might act out and so forth. And we, at the Goldwater Institute a few years ago, published a lengthy analysis of these con laws for psychological care clinics and showed that in some communities, you have situations where police are arresting people and taking them to the hospital that can't care for them, and they get handcuffed to gurneys for 24 hours waiting for some doctor to come and care for them because there aren't facilities available. So we're helping to challenge the application of the con law in Mississippi that restricts the availability of supplies.
We're talking with Tim Sandifer. He's a vice president at the Goldwater Institute, talking about Goldwater's amicus brief that's been filed in the Mississippi Supreme Court this week, connected to a case that is challenging some certificate of need laws down there in Mississippi. And Tim, you know, the reason why I asked you to come on the show here actually is because of something that you wrote in the little write-up at Goldwater's website about this case. And that was that, you know, you're asking the justices in Mississippi to look at the circumstances here through the lens of what's best for patients, for consumers of healthcare, as opposed to what's in the best interest of the existing practitioners in the state, which is obviously what those people have the influence so often with these certificate of need laws. So just unpack that a little more for us. Tell us why that shift would be so important here.
What happened here was the State Department of Health approved the opening of a new clinic, and an existing clinic filed a lawsuit objecting to that, saying, no, no, they should have to prove public need and all this vague nonsense under the law. And that's what's being appealed to the Mississippi Supreme Court, is a question of whether the existing firms have the legal right to file that kind of a complaint. And we draw an analogy to antitrust law. You know, in the 1980s, there was a real change in how antitrust law worked because judges and economists said, you know, maybe the antitrust laws should not protect existing businesses against competition. Maybe they should be focused on protecting consumers. And that really opened up free markets and allowed for the kind of standard of living improvements that we've seen in the past 4 or 5 decades. And we say that the Mississippi Supreme Court should do the same thing when it comes to con laws.
Yeah, I think this really comes down to a question of, like, what is the role of government here? Is it to set a level playing field for everybody and then be a referee? Or is it to provide advantages to the people who got there first, to the incumbent providers in the market? And Tim, you make a compelling argument. I hope the justices are listening to what you guys at Goldwater have to say. We are unfortunately out of time to talk about this today. But Tim, thank you for joining us and walking us through all that.
Thank you.
And that is Tim Sandifer. He is the Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Goldwater Institute. Check out their work online, including more information about this case and the amicus brief they've filed in Mississippi. You can find all that at goldwaterinstitute.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The Declaration of Independence gives us the right to life. It is a right we should fight to protect. So says former Congressman Keith Rothfuss on this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
The year 2026 has arrived, and with it, the momentous 250th anniversary of our Declaration of Independence. While the preparations for the celebration of this milestone are well underway, the witness of tens of thousands of Americans in Washington, D.C. on January 23rd gives us pause to reflect upon those who still believe in what the founders committed us to in Philadelphia in 1776. With the Democrat Party outright rejecting the plain meaning of the Declaration, and certain voices within the Republican Party going wobbly in their commitment to it, today the Declaration is up for grabs. What did the founders commit us to in 1776? It is worth repeating so as to remind us what we are supposed to be celebrating. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Every Democrat leader today has rejected these words. For example, just 3 years ago, then Vice President Kamala Harris discussed the Declaration, but she left out the words she didn't agree with. The Democrat Party's platform has for decades called to make alienable the right to life for for all human beings not yet born. And just last month, Democrats in Pennsylvania's House of Representatives, including the politician representing the area of Independence Hall where the declaration was signed, began the process to eliminate the right to life for the unborn in Pennsylvania's Constitution. For those who still adhere to the entire declaration, take heart. The thousands who marched for life in Washington, D.C. to demand that the federal government fulfill the declaration's promise are with you. For much of the past half century, these marchers have found a home in the Republican Party, which was formed during an earlier era that saw a revival in the understanding of the Declaration. It was the first Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who led that revival. And before he became president, he pleaded with his fellow citizens to reject doctrines that contradicted the great landmarks of our Declaration. Lincoln urged them to hold on to what the founders had called a self-evident truth, that we are created equal with inalienable rights. Until recently, the party of Lincoln has affirmed unabashedly what the Declaration calls the unalienable right to life. Every GOP platform between 1980 and 2020 endorsed a constitutional amendment recognizing that unborn children possess the same right to life as every other human being. Yet today, some in the party of Lincoln are wavering. The GOP's 2024 platform weakened the commitment to this foundational right, and this month, party leader President Donald Trump called for flexibility regarding the long-standing ban on taxpayer funding of abortion. The Trump administration also permitted a generic version of the abortion pill to enter the market, despite well-documented complications associated with the existing drug. And Trump's Department of Justice asked a court to dismiss a legal challenge to the Biden policy that expanded use of the drug. Regrettably, the GOP's wavering is not limited to abortion policy. It is also evident in the manner in which many Republicans uncritically defend the IVF industry. One hopes this stems from ignorance rather than indifference, or worse, because the reality inside IVF laboratories is deeply troubling. Countless human embryos, each a distinct human life, are routinely destroyed in the process as babies are manufactured. Such disregard for the inalienable right to life contradicts the Declaration and undermines the dignity of the smallest members of the human family. Yet not all Republican leaders have abandoned the Declaration's promise. Speaker Mike Johnson recently pushed back forcefully against efforts to weaken the prohibition on taxpayer funding of abortion. It is essential that more Republicans follow Johnson's and Lincoln's lead. With one major political party openly rejecting the Declaration's central moral claim, it is more important than ever that the Republican Party remain committed to the Declaration in its entirety. If certain members of the party of Lincoln are unable to do that, then it may be time for some retirement. This is Keith Rothfuss for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WTIM-AM in Somerville, Massachusetts, KXMC-AM in Troy Hills, New Jersey, along with WOLD-LP in Woodbridge, New Jersey. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.